Nadia Bolz-Weber isn't your typical pastor. Her life involves speaking around the country, tweeting nonstop, and drawing huge crowds and national media attention for her stripped-down-to-the-core version of Christianity. For starters, she's a tattoo-covered former addict who put in time as a stand-up comic before she found her calling.
Her recent memoir was a New York Times bestseller. She's the founding pastor of House for All Sinners and Saints, an ELCA mission church in Denver, Colorado, and the author of Pastrix, The Cranky, Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. Also the sarcastic Lutheran blog, and she's speaking at the First Baptist Church in Madison on January 31st. Pastor Bolz-Weber, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much. I hear it's colder there.
It's not so bad as Wisconsin winters go. We've seen worse.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, it's in the it's at like 70 degrees and sunny right now.
Well, a little bit different then. Well, let's dig into you. When did you first know you had it in you to be a pastor?
I'm still waiting, I think. I feel like I have it in me. I feel like I'm one of these people who just kind of stumbles through what I do every day and never ever feel a sense of mastery of it. But if you're just talking about the sort of when did I first have an inclination to be a pastor, it was a number of years ago, and it really, really was related to the suicide of a friend and having done his funeral. And he was also, you know, somebody who was in recovery, but, you know, struggled with mental illness, and he was also a stand-up comic. So I did his funeral in this downtown comedy club, and it was just packed full of you know, other comics and academics and recovering alcoholics and queers. And I just looked out and I thought, oh my gosh, I think I'm supposed to be a pastor to my people. You know, I don't have a generic sort of call to ministry. It was very particular for me. I wanted to be a pastor to the people in my own sort of context.
So you were religious at that point. You were practicing, I guess, you were practicing Lutheran, and then you just decided to take it a step further?
Yeah, I mean, I had been, you know, I had discovered Lutheranism through my husband. And so, yeah, at that point, I had been, you know, Christian for a number of years in Lutheran church, but I was the only religious person in my friend group, which is how I ended up doing the funeral. They just looked at me and they said, well, you'll do it. You're the only one who goes to church.
You've said that when you were younger, that you were burned by religion. What are your early memories of the Christian fundamentalist religion that you grew up with?
Well, they're mixed. I mean, in all fairness, I mean, there's something beautiful about being raised in community that cares for each other. So that stayed with me as a positive. But there was this very very dualistic way of thinking. You know, we were the only ones who had the truth, and anybody who wasn't this particular brand of Christian wasn't actually Christian, wouldn't be going to heaven. It's very sectarian and kind of fear-based and really controlling of people. And, you know, women couldn't even pray out loud in front of men. I mean, you didn't have the authority to hand a man a collection plate on Sunday, but you did have the authority to hand him a plate of fried chicken an hour later at the church dinner, right? So these gender roles were very, very specified. And, you know, I was kind of this smart-ass kid, and I just didn't, you know, there was no space for me there.
So you left that church. Did you ever give up your belief in God, or did you just try on different faiths to see what fit you?
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing is, I never managed to be an atheist. I when I was a student chaplain, I was you know, with this older woman, and I said, "Do you want me to pray or read from scripture?" And she goes, "Oh, that's nonsense, dear. I'm an atheist." And I just looked at her and I was like, "Oh my God, good for you! I wish I could pull that off. Like, I could just manage to be an atheist. It's just like in me, this thing." And it's like Frank Schaefer said, if I ever wanted to be an atheist, the very first thing I do is pray to God to make me one. So I think, you know, it's just sort of embedded in who I am and how I see the world, even though I spent 10 years not wanting to have anything to do with Christianity. I mean, I had a very deep antipathy towards Christianity for a good 10 years, but I never stopped believing in God.
So you had this deep antipathy for 10 years, and I know it was also for about a decade that you struggled with addiction with drugs and alcohol. How did you find your way back to Christianity then?
Well, you know, it really was having gotten clean and sober. You know, I had this experience where it felt like God pulled me up out of off a path I was on, a path of absolute sort of destruction of myself and other people, and put me on another path. And I couldn't really take credit for it. I mean, it very much felt like this interruption from God. And so, and you know, when you're in recovery, there's a lot, you know, you're supposed to pray and you're supposed to give your life over to the care of God. And so having gone through that sort of process, it really opened me up to possibility of religion again, I think.
And today you're a pastor. You've got a big following that seems to be just growing. But you still call yourself a sarcastic Lutheran, a cranky Lutheran. Why are you cranky and sarcastic?
I don't know, man. I was like, I didn't like develop my personality a few months ago. It was almost like I was born like this. But I think a lot of times, you know, in order to be perceived as being spiritual or perceived as being like a good Christian, it means having a particular affect. Like you, and I've just never. If I were to adopt that affect, it would just be, it would be so false, right? So I just am who I am, and I don't try to pretend to be better than I am. I mean, and in that way, hopefully, it allows to point to God's grace a little bit and like, look, you know, somehow I'm able to do this work by the grace of God. It's not because I have this beautiful sort of predisposition towards being nurturing and caring and sort of this quivering mass of emotional availability for everyone, right? So like even me, with all my flaws, somehow gets to participate a little bit in the redeeming work of God in the world, and that's grace.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the church that you founded, in essence, or at least that the mission, the House for All Sinners and Saints. The way I've heard it described, you meet in sort of an annex, and there's plastic chairs involved. Everyone's sort of on the same level. There's not a lot of, you know, stained glass or beautiful pulpits or a choir or an organist. It's kind of bare bones. Why did you want to do it like that?
Well, because. You know, because of the fact that, look, if you enter most churches in the sanctuary, from the back wall to the front wall, approximately one third of the physical space is for the two special people who get to stand up front, and like everyone else looks at the backs of each other's heads. So if you're someone like me who kind of has a built-in suspicion of institutions or a built-in suspicion of presumed authority, just the way the space is configured is problematic. So we just really democratize the space. And it ends up being welcoming to kind of people like me who get freaked out otherwise. So that's one reason. But we love iconography. We like sort of, you know, Orthodox iconography, and we have candles, we have incense. So it's not completely like stripped down in an austere way. It's just, yeah, we don't have a choir. The whole community is a choir. It's a cappella. So it's like sitting in the middle of a 200-person choir singing in four-part harmony. All the music comes out of the bodies of the people who showed up. Like, I've never understood the idea of removing all the good singers from the rest of the congregation. It's like never made sense to me. So the community itself is a choir. We don't need a special one.
So that's the physical space and all of that. But what about what you offer in house, as it's called? I understand that anybody can take communion. Anybody can help read the liturgy. That's different.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we have an unapologetically open table at House for All. Now, you know, a lot of people disagree with that. They say, well, people shouldn't be taking communion unless they're baptized, as though grace has to happen in a particular order for it to work. And so, yeah, we're very unapologetic about having an open table. I don't really understand the arguments against that, to tell you the truth, because, like, throughout the New Testament, Jesus is always having supper with the wrong people. He's having supper with tax collectors and then, like, prostitutes. He's having supper with people who don't wash their hands. And then the Last Supper, that was the worst, right? Then these guys are about to betray him. They're the worst friends ever. And then Christianity comes along. We're like, you know, the really important thing is that we make sure that the wrong people aren't partaking in the Lord's Supper. It's just not even consistent with the narrative. So, we have an open table, and also anybody can lead the different parts of the liturgy. The word liturgy means the work of the people, so we take that seriously. I mean, I've never offered the sermon as one of the things people can choose to do, but I've considered it a couple weeks.
Well, we're talking right now with Nadia Boltz-Weber. She's the founding pastor of House for All Sinners and Saints, an ELCA mission church in Denver, Colorado. She's the author of Salvation on the Small Screen, and Pastrix, The Cranky Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint.
We want to hear from you. How does all this fit in with your own experience and view of religion? Do you think organized religion in the United States has moved away from its core? What kind of spirituality, what kind of practice do you think people are craving today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with Nadia Boltz Weber. She's the founding pastor of House for All Sinners and Saints, a church in Denver, Colorado. And she's the author of Pastrix as well, the New York Times bestselling book. And we're talking about Christianity in America right now, what people want from it. And our guest herself, she aims to make it more accessible.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is organized religion meeting the needs of American people? Of you. 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We go to our callers now. Matt is first from Racine. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Good, thanks.
Just the one thing I wanted to say is I go to a kind of different, more untraditional Lutheran church in Racine where we have two campuses. We have a traditional campus, which is our actual like church. It has a sanctuary. It has an everything. And then we actually have a separate campus that is out like by the I, which is by us is more of a country area for people that can't get into the Racine to go to church. And we have it in a sports complex banquet hall. And something that we preach forever is that, you know, church isn't an institution. It's the people. And that's what really makes a church, at least for me. And we're the same way as her church, where anyone can take communion, anyone can and help out, anyone can, you know, give communion for us. And I think that's a really big thing for me, is that church needs to be a community of people working together to better each other, not a place.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Matt. And I'm guessing, Nadia, that this is something that would resonate with you. Do you think this is something that people who do identify with organized religion are looking for right now?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that the body of Christ fashions itself in endless variety. And so I would never want to say, you know, there's one effective way to be church. But what I do see is, you know, I've had this congregation of a few hundred people, most of whom would simply not enter another congregation other than ours. This is where they feel comfortable. It's not like we got a few hundred people who were regular churchgoers of other congregations and sort of poached them into ours. It's a very different kind of population. So for them, it's working.
I do want to ask you today, there seems to be an increasing trend of people saying they don't identify with organized religions, saying that they do identify with, they call themselves spiritual instead. What do you make of that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess when I hear that, I hear people saying, I don't want to have anything to do with this sort of obviously fallible institution that can be hypocritical and has all of these problems and can be greedy, but I do want some kind of transcendence in my life. And so I guess what I hear them saying is, I have sought out practices in my life that give me a sense of well-being. That I think when people say that they're spiritual but not religious, that's I think that's what they mean.
I've read you don't like that word, spiritual.
No, it's not my favorite word. No.
How come?
Because again, because I feel like it's again sort of a lot of times I sense it's sort of adopting a particular affect that makes it seem like you've transcended the inconsistencies and annoyances in your life, when I've just never really found anybody who's truly transcended inconsistencies and annoyances in their life and in themselves. They just have figured out how to pretend that they do, and then I just don't really trust that. So, you know, there's that sort of particular affect of having like painfully good posture and speaking with a half whisper and having a passive aggressive smile that people just decided that's what spiritual looks like. And if somebody's genuinely like that, that's fine. But, you know, I trust it more when I feel like people have more like integrated the good and bad parts of themselves rather than try to pretend that the bad parts don't exist.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Ruthie. She's joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ruthie.
Hi. So I just have, a question and a comment. First, I'd like to say I really appreciate sort of your logical and sort of out-of-the-box approach to religion. I find that really refreshing. But my question is, when you were sort of talking about AOD issues and your recovery process and religion and God was a big part of that, I wonder if people in your congregation or people who attend your church have other ideas of how they approach their recovery, and if you're supportive of sort of the approach that's not maybe like a traditional 12-step approach to recovery, and how you sort of deal with that.
Okay, thank you, Reese.
Yeah, I mean, I really am a fan also of harm reduction, which is a system where, you know, not everyone can go cold turkey and do the 12 steps and do all that stuff like I did, but there are people that if they have enough support and love in their life, they can take steps to simply reduce the amount of harm they're doing themselves and other people, and it's really proven to be a very effective thing. So I'm not an ideologue, so you know, I think a lot of different things work for a lot of different people, but all I can do is sort of confess my own faith, my own beliefs, and my own experience, and I'm always happy to do that, but I never want that to be heard as sort of discounting the efficacy of other people's experiences and faith, if you know what I mean.
Well, thank you for that call, Ruthie. We appreciate that. And I want to look a little bit about trends again in faith. And in Canada, for instance, secularism seems to have taken off a lot. It's not quite to that level in the United States. And yet, probably if you ask people about, you know, transcendence, do they want transcendence in their life? Everybody's going to say yes. How do you think about what do you think of that gulf there?
I don't know. I think religion's been done so poorly for so long that I'm never shocked when people don't want to have anything to do with it. Like, I don't want to be disparaging if somebody says, I don't want everything to do with it, because I think there are legitimate reasons why people arrive at that conclusion. I would persuade people to not totally throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I think there are things that that religion offers that that a secular life doesn't offer. For instance, I'm forced to be in community with a lot of people I would never choose out of a catalog, right? I bump up against other human beings that are not the people of my choosing, and I'm sort of changed by that. I get to access these rituals that are, you know, a couple thousand years old that have their own integrity to them. The liturgy and the sacraments have their own integrity. They don't demand my integrity in order to sort of work. And so there's, you know, our sort of sacred texts tell us who we are and who God is in such a particular way, and there are these endless reservoirs of meaning. And so I feel like there's so much good to be had that I would encourage people to maybe reconsider. Just because something's been done badly for so long doesn't mean that there's nothing to be had of it now.
Pastor Boltz-Weber, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the chat.
We've been speaking with Pastor Nadia Boltz-Weber, founding pastor of House for All Sinners and Saints and ELCA Mission Church in Denver, Colorado. She's the author of Pastrix, The Cranky, Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. She'll be speaking in Madison on January 31st at the First Baptist Church.